give for that wonderful phrase.
I'm Anna Sale, in for Leonard Lopate today. And you know that song. Every other month, Patricia T. O'Connor, our resident word maven, comes by to help us figure out some of the quandaries of English grammar, among other things. She's a former editor for the New York Times Book Review, and she's written several books, including Woe Is I, You Send Me, and Words Fail Me. Today, before we get to your calls, she wants to talk about lost words, and I'm happy to welcome her back. Hi, Pat.
Hi, Anna.
What's a lost word?
Well, this is a word. They're not exactly lost. They might have been lost because of changing times if they hadn't somehow redeemed themselves by taking on figurative or metaphorical usages. And I want to talk about some of those. The first one isn't completely lost, but this is what made me think of this topic.
Uh-huh.
A reader emailed recently after seeing the naval term masthead, meaning the top of a ship's mast, in a 19th century novel. Well, this was in a novel by George Meredith, written in 1879, called The Egoist. And there's a passage in it that imagines a sailor being blown from the top, from the masthead, in a gale. And it made the reader think, am I right in assuming that the nautical masthead gave us its periodical sense, meaning the sense in newspapers and magazines? And yes, the answer is yes, it's probably true that that image of the top of the ship's mast inspired the use of masthead in newspapers to mean, it's usually on the op-ed page, a roster of editorial, top editorial staff members and business.
The bosses.
Too. The boss, the brass. And so... Anyway, the fact that masthead was able to take on this figurative meaning gave it new life. There are still sailboats today, and they still have mastheads. But I think to most people, a masthead means now the journalistic sense.
The top of the times.
Yeah, but interestingly, journalism is changing too. So the print media, the magazines and newspapers, are rapidly giving way to the internet. We don't see mastheads so regularly. So it may be that the journalistic sense of masthead will eventually become a lost word.
And then we have to look back to the ships.
Yes.
You have another journalism word that I want to know about, deadline.
Yes. Now, that's an interesting one. This clearly traces its history to the Civil War, when deadline was a term given to a 4-foot-high fence that defined what was called a no-man's land inside the walls around the Confederate prisoner-of-war camp at Andersonville, Georgia. And it was a 4-foot-high railing around the inside of the stockade, about 20 feet from the edge. And it constituted what one officer wrote. He said it constitutes the dead line beyond which the prisoners are not allowed to pass. In other words, they could be shot. And some were. Now, it wasn't until the early 20th century that the term deadline became used in journalism to mean a time limit when a story was due. It also had a slightly earlier meaning in press rooms. A deadline was a rule or a piece of machinery on which a page was aligned. But at any rate, we now know it as, you know, what a deadline means. We all have deadlines. But again, here, you know, journalism is changing so rapidly. Newspapers and magazines and print media don't really, to some extent, they still have deadlines. But the ones that exist on the internet don't really have time deadlines in the old sense. Since
it's just
they're not
perpetual
tied to the
deadlines,
clock.
Yes.
Right. They just keep writing over and over. Nobody ever goes home, etc. So anyway, I thought these were interesting examples of how words accommodate themselves to changing history.
Yeah, deadline. So deadline goes back to a Confederate prison in Georgia.
Yeah.
That's so interesting.
The notorious Andersonville prison. The Confederate officer who was in charge of that prison was eventually hanged for war crimes.
Huh. How about dashboard?
Dashboard is very interesting. Now, you may know this, or you may not, but when automobiles began to be manufactured around the turn of the century, more or less. The coachmakers who made the early automobile chassis, in many cases, were coach companies adapted from making horse-drawn vehicles. And as it happens, they adopted a word from the old technology. Huh. The dashboard on a horse-drawn vehicle was a barrier of wood or leather, some sort of panel or flap, used as a mudguard at the front and sometimes along the sides to prevent passengers from being dashed with mud from the horse's hooves. So these were called dashboards. And when automobiles began to be manufactured, they called that front panel in front of the driver the dashboard.
Huh. So my dashboard now collects dust that it used to actually protect people from it.
Yes.
Earmark. Where did that come from?
Well, it came, it had a very literal meaning. Often, you know, these words did have literal meanings at one time. An earmark was a notch or some other mark put on the ear of a cow or a pig or whatever, some livestock, as a means of identifying it by owner. And in many cases, this is still done on a lot of farms. Mm-hmm. These days now, when we say earmark, we mean to set aside funds for a specific purpose. So we've adopted that as a figurative meaning, which will probably keep that word alive long after real earmarks are no longer being made on animals.
So earmarks on a head of cattle is mm-hmm. the same earmark that they have in Congress.
Yes.
That's so interesting. Now,
etymologically, it is, yeah.
Is there a particular century where, thinking back about lost words that you've studied, where do we lose a lot of the words?
Well, I'm sure that we've lost, you know, thousands and thousands of words over the years. The ones that I'm mentioning, some of them are 19th century words. Earmark, I think that's centuries old. Another one that's centuries old is the word transfixed. Now, we use transfixed to mean fascinated or mesmerized, but it once had a literal meaning, literally to be pierced or stuck through with an arrow or a sword or a spear. It was as if you were stuck to the spot.
Huh.
So that word transfixed, you know, originally meant poked through.
Yeah, being speared.
Being speared, right. And here's a 15th century word. In the 1400s, tenterhooks, the word was born. These were nails or pointed L-shaped hooks that were set along the edges of a wooden frame called a tenter that was used for stretching or drying newly woven woolen cloth. The cloth would be woven, washed, and then stretched on a tenter, and the tenter hooks were what held it onto the frame. Now, in the 18th century, people began using that word figuratively. So to be on tenter hooks was to be held in suspense, to be like stretched on a rack.
Wow. We are getting some lost word submissions from listeners. We've heard from Patrick on Twitter. He mm-hmm. points out epicenter. It should mean the point above an earthquake. It should mean a point above an earthquake center, but now means the center of the center.
Right. Now people say, oh, this is the epicenter of the crisis, meaning the heart of it. And actually, epicenter didn't always mean heart. It meant, as he says, a point above the ground.
Ben has suggested garble. It used to mean to sift. Then it acquired the connotation of motivated misrepresentation or jumbling.
Oh, well, that's news to me.
So
I didn't
do
know about
you garble flour before you make a cake?
I guess so.
I'm going to start saying that.
I guess so.
You can send your lost words to us on Twitter. Use the hashtag lost words. We're also taking your calls 212-433-9692. If you don't have a lost word but just have a question for Pat, you can call 212-433-WNYC. David on Facebook also suggested tenterhooks. Mm-hmm. He added brass monkey.
Brass monkey, that's a new one to me.
the phrase also toe the line.
Oh, yeah, toe the line. That's true. That literally was a, it wasn't always a figure of speech. It was literal. That when you, well, maybe David can explain it. He probably has looked it up more recently than I have.
David, if you're still out there, give us a call at 212-433-9692. But John in Forest Hills, New York is there. John, you've got a lost word?
Well, I'm not sure it's lost word, perhaps, but my father's mother and father, I call my grandmother grandfather. My father's aunt and uncle, I call my great aunt and uncle. Mm-hmm. What happened to grand aunt and uncle?
Oh, those words are still in existence. It's just they aren't as popular as great.
Yeah, I know.
You
I,
can
I,
say grand aunt and grand uncle, mm-hmm. just like you can say grand niece or great niece.
Yeah, but it's still accepted to call my father's aunt my great aunt, is mm-hmm. how people would expect it. And how did that develop, that we skipped a generation there?
Oh, we didn't skip a generation. Great or grand are used interchangeably to mean removed by one generation.
Oh.
Or I guess yeah. it would be by two.
Right, because we have my great-grandmother and great-great-grandmother, et cetera.
Yes.
Aha.
As you add removals, mm-hmm. you use the word great. So you could say great-great-aunt. You could say great-grand-aunt, but I think that would be a little confusing.
I think so.
Yeah.
Thanks so much for your call, John.
Thank you. Love the segments.
I wanted to mention one lost word that I think is interesting because many people think this is an anti-feminist word, and I think there are misconceptions about it, and that's the word distaff. Huh. When people say, well, this is the opinion on the distaff side, what they mean is that's the feminine viewpoint. And that's a legitimate way to use that word. But the word distaff is not pejorative. The dis isn't as in disrespect, or it's not a negative prefix. The distaff is simply a staff that in the 11th century was wound with unspun flax or wool. And the dis in the word distaff was probably from an old German word, disa, meaning a bunch of unspun flax. So the word distaff came to be associated with women's work because women did the spinning in a household often. And it's now a noun or adjective referring to the feminine side of things. But because of that, a lot of people think that it's a negative word, that the dis is a negative prefix. And huh. that's not true.
Just refers to the traditionally women's
the
work.
The material, the unspun flax or wool.
Interesting. Well, we are speaking with word maven Pat O'Connor, and we're taking your questions and calls about the intricacies and idiosyncrasies of the English language. You can call us at 212-433-9692, leave a comment on our show page, or find us on Facebook and Twitter, where our handle is at Leonard Lopate. We'll be back with more after a break.
What I'd give to hear those three little words. Man, that's such a wonderful phrase.
I'm Anna Sale, in today for Leonard Lopate, here with our word maven, Pat O'Connor. And we're talking about lost words, words that have lost their original meaning but are still used commonly in language and conversation. Mark in New Jersey, you've got a submission?
Hello, Anna. Hello, Pat. Yes, the word enormity seems to have morphed from its original meaning, where it was a noun and meant something that was greatly wicked, mm-hmm. and now is simply used as a synonym for large,
right?
Anything that's big. So I wonder if Pat could talk about that.
Yeah, I don't think that's not the kind of words I've been talking about are words that survive in a metaphorical or figurative sense. Enormity is changing in the way it's used because of misuse. Now, you're right. It's been used. Yeah, it's been used for just to mean enormousness. And I think it didn't have anything to do with largeness in its beginnings. It just had to do with something grossly unacceptable or wicked. like the Holocaust. But because we talked about big things that were wicked, I think people got the idea that enormity just meant something big.
Huh.
And no, the it's not enormousness.
So that's important. Did you hear that?
It's not size.
It's incorrect if you use enormity and not to mean something evil or sinister.
Yes.
What's another lost word?
Well, one interesting one is bellwether.
Mm-hmm.
That the original sense of that is all but lost. It originally, the bellwether, well, a wether, spelled W-E-T-H-E-R, was a castrated ram that was used, he wore a bell and he led the flock. So he was called a bellwether. He was belled and he was a wether.
Huh.
Now, because he led the flock, the term bellwether acquired a figurative sense, meaning something that signals a future trend or something that's leading us somewhere, a sign that leads, it points somewhere, leads us somewhere. So even though we don't have a lot of sheep herders among us anymore, well, there are some, but bellwether is no longer a household term in its original sense.
But it really means noisy ram. That's so interesting. Bree in Clinton Hill, you have a lost word?
I do. Deep-seated. And why isn't it deeply seated anyway?
Well, because deep and deeply are both adverbs.
Oh.
So we can say either deep-seated or deeply seated. Adverbs are much understood parts of speech. That's a whole other show. The same with slow and slowly. They both can be adverbs, and they both have been adverbs since Old English. But no, that's why we say this river runs deep. We don't have to say it runs deeply.
Okay.
So deep-seated is perfectly correct.
And what about seated? For a while, a friend of mine, this came up from a conversation on Facebook. My friend Gustav posted this question because he thought, as did I, that it was deep-seated, as in a seed.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
But it's seated.
Seat.
So
S-E-A-T.
Where is that from?
Well, something deep-seated meant deeply entrenched. And it's an odd thing because deep-seated sounds enough like it that it's not surprising that they would be confused. But the original image is of something seated or entrenched or, placed rather than buried.
Thank you so much for your call, Bree. John in New Jersey, you've got a solution to the brass monkey mystery. Where did it come from?
Yeah, brass monkey, to my understanding, was a device that was on wooden ships to hold cannonballs. They were made out of brass because they were non-conductive. It couldn't create a spark. So when they were firing cannon, powder would get all over the deck of the wooden ship. And naturally, if there was a spark, it would combust and cause a fire. So they would make the monkeys that would hold the cannonballs on the ship out of brass.
Huh.
Oh, that's very interesting.
Thank you, John, in New Jersey.
That's why they got that phrase, when it's cold enough to freeze the balls off a brass monkey, they mean that it's so cold because the steel would get colder faster than the brass, and they would fall off.
Aha. Thanks
you know,
for that little extra tidbit.
There is another term with brass that is another example of a lost word, or in this case a lost phrase, brass tacks. When we say we're getting down to brass tacks, it means we're getting down to business. Well, the way that phrase originated was that in early mercantile days when yard goods were sold, which they hardly are anymore. It's hard to find yard goods. But when the cloth would be measured out by the yard, there were tacks along the counter to show where the cloth should be cut. So that when something was down to the brass tacks, it was being measured exactly.
Huh. We're measuring twice and cutting once. It's
yes.
Time to do it. That's interesting. Peter in Glen Ridge, New Jersey, you've got a lost word?
I'm the measurement expert. I'm glad you mentioned that. I called last week about Fahrenheit. But moving on here, and by the way, this is a coincidence because while I was on hold, I heard an advertisement for the Fiasco Theater, and it popped into my mind that I had looked up fiasco, what that means. Do you know, Patricia?
No, I'm sure it's an Italian word, right?
Yes. Well, it means flask. And what happened was that when they had made a flask and it was no good, they threw it away. So it was called a fiasco.
Oh, I love that.
Anyway, what I'm calling about is, I know of two words, and I hope you know more, is jet, as in jet black, and winnow, as in winnow out. Because we don't use the original meaning. A lot of people don't know jet refers to coal. So it was black as jet coal. And winnowing is a process used in wheat. It could say would blow wind on it and the hull would blow away.
Right.
And so that was winnowing out to make white wheat.
Yes.
So that was winnowing was a process. So we use the word winnow not knowing its, you know, original meaning.
It's like the word cultivated. We say she's a cultivated person. That also came from agriculture, and it meant literally plowed, cultivated, cared for, as a crop is cared for and grown.
So this is interesting. Our like 100 years ago, everyone knew what jet was when they, you know, brought coal into their house. You know, they wanted jet because it was the highest quality.
Yes.
Coal.
Also, ladies wore jet beads and had jet beads like embroidered on their clothing and on their hats and things. And there were bugle beads made of jet that were great decorations among Victorian ladies.
So jet black really means high class black.
Or deep black.
Deep black.
Yeah, yeah.
Peter, thank you for your call. We're getting lots of comments as well on Facebook. One asked Nora, she says, what did blockbuster originally mean?
Oh, gosh, that's a good one. Of course, we know that it had has a showbiz term, something that blows out the windows in the ticket booth. But I don't know the literal meaning of blockbuster.
You've sent Nora to her dictionary. You've sent Pat to her dictionary,
Nora.
You've sent
me to my dictionary here.
Other question
don't have
we've gotten
blockbuster
on Facebook.
In here.
If anybody out there knows, go to the Facebook
page.
Here it is.
A large, powerful bomb. Yeah, originally something explosive enough to blow up a city block.
Wow.
Well, that doesn't sound right to me. But, okay. It sounds like it ought to have a more literal meaning, like something when you're chopping wood on a chopping block and you hit it so hard that you break the block. But that's what I was expecting, but I don't see that here.
Blowing up a city block, that's quite a literal definition there in the dictionary.
Yeah.
A listener left a comment saying, toe the line came from a line in the House of Commons past which speakers, regardless of their exuberance, were forbidden to pass.
Okay. I was thinking that maybe it was sports.
Uh-huh.
That like the starting line, you had to toe a starting line before taking off at the shot. Maybe I'm wrong. This is something I haven't researched.
Anne in Flatbush, you have a good question to follow up on our conversation about earmarks. What's your question?
Hi. Hello. Yes, I wanted to ask about the origin of pork barrel when referred to in politics.
Pork barrel. Okay. Well, I know it comes from American politics of the 19th century. Let me see if I can find it here.
Consulting the very thick, impressive dictionary in the studio again.
Meanwhile, I can tell you about another one. Loophole.
Loophole?
While I'm looking up pork barrel. Loophole is an interesting word. It comes from the days of castles and moats and knights errant. Castles had slits, narrower slits, like windows, that were for peeping out to look at invading forces and for shooting through. The reason they were called loopholes is because of they came from a Dutch word, loop, loopen, to look or to peer or to sight. It's the same source of the jeweler's loop that he looks through a at a diamond with. And today, a loophole means an escape route or some point of ambiguity, some flaw in a contract or something that gives you an out. But in the old days, it referred to, this goes back to the 1300s.
Part of a castle to shoot a weapon through.
Yes, yes.
Interesting. Pork barrel was the question from Anne and Flatbush.
Pork barrel. This is funny. The original meaning is a barrel for storing pork. That tells us a lot. Okay, it says slang, a government project or appropriation that yields jobs or other benefits and patronage opportunities. Well, we know that. How did it come to be associated with a barrel for storing pork? Well, that's our question, and it's unanswered.
Go to Facebook and Twitter and help us out if you have more to add about pork barrel. Scott in Queens, what's your question?
Hi, yes. Don't know if you've done any research on forgive. I've been off and on studying it for 30 years, ever since my father said, Jesus never said to forgive your enemy. And I said, what are you talking about? The whole world thinks he did. And so I was set out to prove him wrong and found out that our definition of forgiveness is very different. And I know this doesn't go from the morphing into something. It goes back to one of your earlier callers about just defining a word. But the Jewish concept and the Christian concept in the Bible was the word means to remove, to send away, to forsake, to divorce. And a scholar pointed out to me that in the Greek, it's always in the pronoun's always in the dative case, so that God never forgives a person. We don't forgive each other. We forgive the sin. We remove the debt. Loan forgiveness. You remove the debt from the person. So God never forgives you. He removes your debt from you. He removes your sin from you.
Right.
He sends away your sin.
Right. We have that to forgive a debt. I should mention,
but we
though,
use it to mean, which adds great confusion, to mean release yourself or remove anger from you.
Mm-hmm.
And that really, biblically, is never used. It's just not a definition. It's not a use in the Bible. That's a term for meekness.
Okay, we should add, though, that I do want to add one thing in this discussion, that forgiveness does come from Old English, and the Bible wasn't written in Old English. So there's probably a translation difference there.
I've been speaking with Pat O'Connor, our word maven, about lost words and other questions. You can reach her through email at mailbox@grammarphobia.com. She'll be back March 15th. Pat, thanks again.
Thank you.